Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Feeling Seen podcast, the podcast that talks about the movies that make us feel seen. I am here today with one of, it's really an honor. It's one of the predominant voices in horror and genre cinema today. Maybe you became acquainted with his work way back when in those original VHS days. You can get reacquainted with it in the new, some new VHS days coming up. Recently, maybe you were dazzled by the Rebecca Hall-led and David Bruckner-helmed The Night House. Maybe you are like, hey guys, The Ritual is maybe one of the best slept-on horrors of the past like 10 years. Or maybe you are a fan of Hellraiser and you recently caught that movie in its Hulu debut. David Bruckner, what else do the people need to know about you before we kick it off officially today?
Thank you for that. I think that's it. I think you covered it pretty much.
Okay.
I came up doing anthologies, so yeah. I was doing, you mentioned VHS, I kind of cut my teeth on all kinds of anthologies. I just did one called Southbound, mm-hmm. if people have seen Southbound, and then we did one even before that called The Signal, which is very precious to me. And so I'm just happy to be alive and working in horror and and happy to be here. So thank you.
Well, I think I will actually start mm-hmm. off with because I was able to interview Ty West for this earlier when he was on doing the mm-hmm. rounds for Pearl. I feel like it was that era, that sort of coterie of filmmakers who were coming up in the early mid-10s in that sort of anthology realm when anthologies were really hitting a zenith. Like, an anthology is a structure where your mileage may vary depending on the entry, but that was a time when a horror anthology was coming out. It was kind of like, I kind of think every one of these is going to be really good. Like, we were really spoiled in that time. And I wanted to hear from you about what that era was like for you and what the sort of attitude was in your little filmmaking repertory when you guys were, you know, now we know that you were planting the seeds for a time that would be yielding so much more years later with obviously Ty making the Maxine trilogy and you with this like excellent string of films. And then Adam Wingard is over here making fucking Godzilla movies. Like, what was the tenor of that era like for you?
Yeah, no, this, I'm so glad you asked. Yeah, I mean, I came out of Atlanta, so there was, I was lucky to be surrounded by a group of people who were super prolific, always making things, and we didn't know what we didn't know. So we weren't super industry focused, you know, and I didn't go to film school. I ended up in my early 20s working in a theater in Atlanta called Push Push Theater. And their mentality was that their funding was based on workshopping ideas. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, you invite an audience in on that, as opposed to sort of a mandate where you have to put butts in seats. So the kind of community that formed around that, some of us were filmmakers, were just excited about the idea of like, let's just go make stuff and try things. And that was very much the spirit of it. And so there was really from the mid-aughts into kind of VHS, which was 2011, 2012, and then beyond a bit, there was this mentality of like, just do things. As little friction as humanly possible. Take out your 2005 DVX-100 in 24p and just go shoot something. And if you can make films with frequency and relieve the burden of all this artifice from the filmmakers, then you get more of a audience filmmaker relationship. You can just make things quicker and you can get feedback quicker. And so we took that theater's mentality and turned it into a film program that we called the Dailies Project. And the Dailies Project is we throw challenges out to the community and just say, everybody go make, go tell a story that is the same action. Everybody go do a seduction, mm-hmm. you know, or everybody go film a movie in Piedmont Park in Atlanta and incorporate this element from another short film. Mm-hmm. And then we would screen these at local venues and that really became my film school. Mm-hmm. And so out of that emerged a movie called The Signal, which was kind of an exquisite corpse drawing where I went and shot the first part of a feature film and then handed it off to the next filmmaker and so on and so forth. And that got us into Sundance as a huge surprise, just like an offering to the cinema gods. But we shot it for $50,000 in 13 days. And then we got started. And from there, I was really fortunate to get to work on VHS. And that's where I met, you know, Ty and Glenn McQuaid and the Radio Silence guys and Simon Barrett, Joe Swanberg, and and Adam, and then everybody was kind of doing that thing. Like, that was sort of the entire group. Mm. And some of those kids were just churning movies out really, really quickly. And I was just so impressed by what they were able to do. But that was, yeah, that was very much the spirit of the era. And then we all got studio jobs and we started waiting around to get our movies made. And got pulled into the grinder, and it was a whole different experience at that point.
Well, I find that it's just such an interesting, I wanted to make sure and ask you about it to try and get mm-hmm. like a full built out perspective of as many people as I can from that time, because I find it so fascinating mm-hmm. with that sort of run and gun, just make mentality that's running headlong mm-hmm. into the prevailing sort of studio mores of the day, which is excess, which is remakes, which is big and glossy and shiny and taking very, like, the era of the sexy ensemble pulled straight from the WB before it was the CW, and, like, add a stunt cast, throw a Paris Hilton in there, throw an R&B star in there. Like, it was such an machine precision, prolific IP factory at that time. I know that people talk in a lot of terms like that then, but I love that era of horror. It's glorious garbage, but it is mm-hmm. so in its ethos the opposite of what you guys were doing. It was kind of an incredible era of counter programming to the prevailing mentality of what horror should look like on a big screen.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, that's great to think about. And I mean, I think some ways, like, VHS was kind of a response to the fact that found footage had suddenly run rampant and that it was a cheap way for studios to make huge dollars. And so we thought, well, let's all go do our own little found footage shorts. And because they're shorts, you know, you can kind of get in late and get out early. You don't kind of wear the burden of a three-act structure that you have to maintain with an audience. And so they were, and even in resurrecting VHS in recent years, we've talked about it as, like, they're fuck you movies. And so it felt like a reaction against all of that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's also just filmmaking, and it's also found footage is awesome. And, you know, we really enjoyed making the film. So we sort of ended up, I think, in a synergistic place with some of the directors on the other side. And then some of us, like, I got attached quite early in 2013, 2014 to a Friday the 13th movie.
Of course.
And spent a lot of time. You got to work with some great writers kind of looking at what that reboot might be. And I'm, like, really happy it didn't happen, because I think I wouldn't have been ready to just navigate the political atmosphere of a studio at that point. I don't know that I am yet either. But yeah, it was an interesting collision of forces. And I would say that the dilemma kind of persists in some ways of, you know, can you afford to afford the risk of doing your own thing on a small scale and then really, really honing your own particular voice? I recently did moderated a Q&A for Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead, Something in the Dirt, which I absolutely loved.
Mm-hmm.
And those are two filmmakers that have managed to stay in that space and really cultivate it and build a model around it that's really great. Mm-hmm. So I find that super admirable. And then at the same time, it's fun to take on bigger toys. It's fun to think larger and kind of engage in the studio world and take a shot at it. So the struggle continues.
I think that's a perfect sentiment, honestly, to segue into the foundation conversation. That we're, like, speaking of navigating mm-hmm. the political forces of the institution, the movie mm-hmm. that you have brought for us to discuss today is the classic Broadcast News, and the character is Holly Hunter in her tour de force performance as Jane, the Broadcast News segment producer.
It starts off with this very high-tech syntho-sequency type thing, like this. That's the news. Then the strings take the melody.
You are a fan, clearly.
Oh, man, oh, man. A junkie for journalism narratives.
Yeah, you know, me too. And like, I think in general, just workplace narratives altogether,
yeah.
I love. And as a genre filmmaker, most of the time you're dealing with friendships. I've made a bunch of movies about friendships. Mm-hmm. You're dealing with the family. It's like you sometimes can't get the politics of the workplace into a genre film.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there's so much to be mined there that's kind of fascinating. And it's where we spend most of our lives. And filmmakers, film writers, we're all kind of workaholics. Mm-hmm. So like this, it's a place I'm at a lot. So I've always had an affinity for those kinds of movies. And in particular, journalism movies, because it's storytelling on a mass scale. And I love thinking about how stories are translated and how they affect our perception. And some of my early movies, we mentioned The Signal. I mean, The Signal is about a kind of rogue frequency, mm-hmm. that's driving people to violence, but it's emanating from something somewhere, mm-hmm. and it's ending up on all your devices. And that was very much a kind of satire about media run rampant. Mm-hmm. And even my VHS short, I thought, was about the pervasiveness of pornography. And it's like, if in 2011, it's like, you know, for young men, everything they learned about sex, they learned from, you know, mm-hmm. Pornhub or something, then they would emulate something that looked like a Girls Gone Wild video. And of course, then this becomes this like interesting satire that you can inject into horror. And so that was... Journalism, media was always just a place that really, really fascinated me.
I wondered if there was any sort of journalistic spark, mm-hmm. for you when you were younger, perhaps when you saw this, if that was ever a pull for you or if that was just totally ancillary.
No, it would always scare the responsibility, the direct responsibility of it would scare the shit out of me. Yeah, I don't think I,
it should.
You know,
that
I couldn't
imagine.
That is
a good, healthy respect to have for the art and science of journalism. You're absolutely correct.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and but I think also a lot of it came out of just being frankly kind of addicted to punditry at a certain yeah. time, like the rise of cable news in the mid-aughts when that came about, mm. was you could feel the world changing in a way that would be the precursor in some ways to our kind of like hyper divided, you know, tribalistic, mm-hmm.
the crossfire era.
I actually saw when Jon Stewart was on Crossfire. I caught it the day it came on.
I watched
just
that live,
cheering. But oh, you did too.
Yep,
yeah,
yep.
Yeah. That was a moment. Yeah, and who would think that Tucker Carlson would ascend as he has?
He would.
Into
he would like,
hyper villainy.
Yeah, he would ascend so high. In fact, the snake would start eating its tail, and he would begin an infinite descent into the bowels of hell. Truly. Paul Begala, dead in a ditch. We don't know. Like that Crossfire ended. Crossfire ended a lot of things.
Yeah, yeah. He could be the devil himself. We don't know. we'll see what happens.
He's in the Leviathan.
Yeah. Certainly. That would be an interesting mashup. But but I found it was kind of in that era that I really fell in love with broadcast news in particular. Mm. And it was a lot of movies like that. It was Insider. It was Network was a big one.
Yeah.
But Network did this too, even 10 years previous, but broadcast news really, it was topical to all that. Like it sort of saw some of this coming, mm-hmm. and a lot of the underlying tension was about what would happen necessarily once entertainment injected the news. Mm-hmm. And Jane Craig, Holly Hunter's character, is really, she's an idealist at the center of her craft who is trying to maintain it and its integrity almost, you know, to the point of her own self-destruction and peril, mm-hmm. in some ways. And there's a consequence to that. And maybe she takes it too far.
Mm-hmm.
Against sort of the forces of the market coming in some ways. And so, TV news journalism is filmmaking. And so it's just natural to mm-hmm. kind of watch that and see how she's immersed in the world around her and the kind of daily challenges that she faces that is easy to relate to in that regard. But I should also say that I think what's kind of extraordinary about the film is that it's really a love triangle.
Yes. One of the most incredible, compelling character interaction dynamic that's ever been captured on film. The magic of Albert Brooks, Holly Hunter, and William Hurt. Mm-hmm. My God, it is electric with all of them.
Yeah, yeah, they're fantastic. I watched it again last night. We had a friend in town. She'd never seen it, and she was just glued to the screen. And I probably watch it every couple of years, but I just was like so in love with the way they find a synergy between all the conflicts of this romance playing itself out, but they find it in the workplace, you know, and you start to see flirtation manifest as people are working together when they get that kind of synergistic high of creating great news, of filmmaking in the moment in some ways, that there's a real point of connection there. And then just the jockeying for status that happens internally. You know, your podcast is about relating to this stuff. So I should say that, like, you know, a lot of what it's about also, I think, is Jane's experience as a woman in the workplace. And it's very much a snapshot of 80s journalism. Yeah. So some of the kind of politics of, you know, dating in the workplace are things that it's very much a time capsule for the 80s. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't translate the way we might imagine to today. And then I think it's very much like Jane's experience as a woman there. And, you know, obviously for me, I just relate more to kind of the craft and the filmmaking and sort of the, you know, the ideas of someone who's overcommitted to what she's trying to do and is sometimes struggling to connect to the other individuals around her outside of that.
Tom's not ready for the job you're about to hand him. Not near ready. Not by the longest shot. Now, Aaron spent 6 weeks in Tripoli. He's interviewed Gaddafi. He reported on the 81 story. I think he's essential to do the job we're capable of. And I think it's my responsibility to tell you that.
Okay, that's your opinion. I don't agree.
It's not opinion.
You're just absolutely right. And I'm absolutely wrong. It must be nice to always believe you know better. To always think you're the smartest person in the room.
Do you also sit in hotel rooms and cry alone for minutes at a time before re-engaging with the world around you?
I mean, production's a lot like that. Yeah. Yeah. Production's an extremely lonely, terrifying experience where you have to be on all the time and you're typically way out on a limb and you just don't know what's going to land and what's not to and not going to. And you're sort of hanging on to an idea or a belief in an idea or a belief in the way you come to ideas and you're having to convince everybody around you to just stay on that train and continue. And sometimes it feels like a foolish obsession and yet you have to kind of continue. There's a really amazing moment in the film where they're somewhere in Central America, her and Albert Brooks.
I think it's Nicaragua.
Yeah. And they suggest that one of the soldiers put on his boot and they catch it on camera. And she just has to run in and say, wait, don't put on that boot. We do not invent the news.
Póngase las botas. Put on the boot.
No, Manny, no. What the hell? No, stop. We are not here to stage the news. You wait and you see what they do.
Okay.
Sir, you can do whatever you want. It's your choice.
And so he has to sit there with like a camera pointed at him and decide if it's going to be an action captured and not created. And you just instantly see the absurdity of trying to maintain this stuff. And I don't know, that feels a lot like some of the things that you hang on to in the weeds of filmmaking. But yeah.
Well, it's the simplest story. It's broadcast news is we follow these three protagonists, perhaps some antagonist in there as well, as like they are at the DC bureau of a broadcast news station in Washington, DC. And Albert Brooks is the dogged, incredibly dedicated, hard-nosed reporter, go anywhere, cover any assignment. Holly Hunter is the obsessive, furiously capable executive producer. And William Hurt is the handsome, never really had to work hard a day in his life guy who just keeps falling into opportunities because he's an anchor. And as Holly lines out for us at the beginning of the movie, her sort of entire ethos is she is she is living in reaction to, at this point, the celebrityification of the news, where it has become so anchor-driven and so image-driven, as represented by people like William Hurt, that it comes at the expense of actual dedicated journalism. And we follow them as this love triangle plays out and the highs and lows, evergreen topic of your job safety in a newsroom in America.
Oh, that's so well put. Yeah, that's totally it. And I think one of the things that I really love about it is that there's such a humanist approach to the characters in the filmmaking. So you feel for everybody. And I think like I don't just relate to the Jane Craig character. Mm-hmm. Like, I relate to the other two newsmen in their various ways. Mm-hmm. And Tom, William Hurt's character is, I mean, if you've ever been in over your head, you know, or known that that you're a little bit unprepared for something and you have to try to keep up in the environment around you. Mm-hmm. Like, he is that manifest.
Real fake it till you make it.
He absolutely, and he's actually trying in earnest to be clear about that, but he's so punished from the people around him constantly in the beginning. Mm-hmm. That he kind of can't announce his lack of education towards the matter. He just is constantly getting brutalized for it. And then Albert Brooks is this, there's such a diligence to everything that he's doing. And at the same time, he just can't seem to connect with people. Mm-hmm. On what's happening necessarily. And it's like, I feel like I couldn't really put my finger on which of those roles I've spent the most amount of time in between the three of them. I feel like the experience of making something is to oscillate between these various positions. Mm-hmm. Continually. Mm-hmm. At all times, you know. And they're just so wonderfully carved in that way. And some of the sweetest moments are just seeing when their approaches have to collide. Mm-hmm. And seeing the conflicts that ensue, like seeing William Hurt try to train Albert Brooks as to how to do the anchor position.
Just remember that you're not just reading the news or narrating. Everybody has to sell a little. You're selling them this idea of you. You know, you're sort of saying, trust me, I'm credible. So when you feel yourself just reading, stop. Start selling a little.
Which, of course, fails in a horrible way. And
the flop sweat.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's painful to watch.
It's
I feel
agony.
Like it's like British office level agony to see on the screen.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is like a horror film in its own right, if social anxiety were a genre nightmare. But
well, watching this last night and then knowing that you're like, you know, like you said, you've gone from that like sort of very independent, make it however you can make it, and then like going and then working with studios and waiting for your movie to get made and working through those various iterations of being a director in this industry. It made me think of, there was a recent profile of the director Nikiatu Jusu in Vulture. Mm. Done by Angelica J. Mm. Bastian. And she had a quote that was broken out as a pull quote that I really have hung on to. And that she says, the more you see of the figurative monster that is the industry, the more you assess what you're willing to do to get what other people have gotten. And I was watching this movie and this quote came into my head, and I'm watching Holly Hunter push back in that tension between trend and tradition and her complete moral correctness, and knowing too that like as at any juncture in the industry, I would imagine there's this tension that you find as a director, but I would imagine as there are more masters and more high profile masters, those check writer people that you are working for and with and around, I wanted to hear from you about your own path walking through that tension, like that sort of bridge that you cross when you kind of realize that either you or people around you are making choices about how to get what other people have gotten. And we have very clear roadmaps for the very horrible examples of what people have done in this industry to obtain what others before them have had. And I wanted to hear you discuss a bit that, like, the Jane in you competing. Mm-hmm. Against, butting up against the nature of the industry and how that's been for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Great question. Yeah. I mean, I think, well, first of all, one thing it's interesting to me about the film Broadcast News is just to say that, again, these characters are archetypes. And so for me, that's how I view it.
I think,
so it's like,
I mean, we meet them as archetypes. When we meet them in the cold open at the beginning of the movie, they're child versions of themselves. And they're so concentrated. They must grow up to become the adults that we meet immediately after this.
Look, it's time for you to go to sleep.
I just have two more pink pills, then I'm all done.
Finish quickly. I don't want you getting obsessive about these things. Good night.
Right, right. And it's beautifully told and so funny to sort of track that across the film. And I think, but it's not, you know, they're forces that live inside us. Mm-hmm. You know? And so, so Jane's kind of plea to keep everything sacred is something I struggle with. I'm sure any working artist struggles with, but mm-hmm. It is also at some level or another kind of unattainable. Like, mm-hmm. filmmaking is always born of compromise. Mm-hmm. So before you have to deal with the bankers, and mass audiences in the very narrow landing strip that is a studio film necessarily.
Yeah.
There's just the realities of filmmaking. Mm-hmm. You know, there's all the things you want to get done on a day and you can't get done on a day, and mm-hmm. And all the things that you can't see coming. And so there's always this, it's always somewhere between the concept of what you have in your mind and the spirit of what that is, and then just the haphazard nature of many, many different minds coming together in a very short window of time and having to produce something, mm-hmm. And seeing where you land. And it's always a bit of an act of faith in that regard to just know that you're going to land somewhere, mm-hmm. and that you can steer the ship a little bit, but that you can't steer it completely. Mm-hmm. And that you sometimes just kind of have to lean into the way things are going and roll with it and have the humility to respect that. And
well, and then I would imagine experiencing that on a whole escalated level with, like, you directed episodes of Creepshow, but then, like, coming into the endeavor that is Hellraiser. It's like, speaking of predecessors.
yeah. Well, that's a situation, like, that's for me, like, my first studio film. And that's
so crazy to think about. That's so crazy to think about. You've done so much and you've been busy for so long. It's just like, oh, wow, that's the first studio. And Nighthouse is so beautiful. It's so polished, like, crazy.
Yeah. I mean, we were very lucky with those movies. We got to sell them at film festivals, but we were, you know, kind of largely left alone on that. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, we were left alone on Hellraiser 2. But I would say, I mean, that's the first time there was an expectation about what we might create, and a long history of trying to get Hellraiser movies made in the studio system. Mm-hmm. So it's, I wouldn't say there was a bunch of, like, cigar-chewing, like, suits that are sort of dictating, you know, it's not Mulholland Drive, like, this is going to be the girl. You know, it's not this sort of insidious, like, cloaked in shadow engineering of how the film will be. But there are, I think, what emerge sort of ideas about what can succeed mm-hmm. in a market, because mm-hmm. you do eventually have to convince bankers to pay for what you're doing, and, like, what will persist, or how you might have to approach the story that has been kind of learned behavior over the years, mm-hmm. and sort of everybody takes that experience into something. And so out of that does emerge kind of an idea of what you can do. Mm-hmm. And some of it's just, you know, like, coming on board to something and recognizing where it's going and what it's going to be. And if you can see a vision for that and you can love it, it's like, then it very much becomes a collaborative art form. But no, I mean, like everything in filmmaking, it's not born without compromise.
Have you, like, and then there, you know, and there's that great mm-hmm. blow up that Jane has in the airport with Tom, where she, you know, realizes this ethical breach that he's made in putting out a very sensitive segment about sexual assault. And she learns that, like, he contrived a scenario in which he cried on camera and then opted to edit that in explicitly. So he looked very tender. So it was a real hero moment for him.
You could get fired for things like that.
I got promoted for things like that.
Working up tears for a news piece cutaway. You totally crossed the line between what is ethical and what is garbage.
It's hard not to cross it. They keep moving a little sucker, don't they?
And he's like, yeah, but then the line just keeps moving. So, like, where does it end? Like, where, like, the boundary's too blurred. And what I want to hear from you is, if you, do you feel like you have been spared the kind of, like, ethical sitting with yourself moments where you've had to decide, like, am I going to go this route? Am I being given a note that I feel really uncomfortable with and I'm going to have to make a hard choice? Or do you feel like you have kind of managed to skate around those sort of scenarios? Or is that something you have faced in your own career?
I would say I'm, first of all, I love that moment because he makes his case, mm-hmm. you know, his case is, for those of you who've seen it, it's like, well, I was crying anyway. Mm-hmm. So what if I spun the camera around and cried again? Like, like you're saying, where is the line necessarily? Mm-hmm. And for Jane, that's well across it. And, I think, those ethical kinds of quandaries absolutely emerge, in filmmaking. I mean, we're making genre films, so we don't have to, there's not sort of truth in journalism that we have to maintain, but there is a sensitivity that at times has to emerge about certain subjects. It's mm-hmm. like, I think you have to take the story seriously. You have to know that there are, particularly with something like Nighthouse, you're dealing with suicidal ideation, mm-hmm. depression, anxiety. It's like, these are, and you're also making a genre film that's got to be fun, that people have to enjoy. And somewhere between making the story make sense, making the story a fun ride on a Friday night,
yeah,
and being true to the real experiences that people have, there are quandaries that emerge that come into play in sort of how are you going to represent this? Mm-hmm. And I've been fortunate that I've never had a huge pushback on something mm-hmm. where sort of somebody behind the money wanted us to do something that felt overtly wrong or like we were misrepresenting something. Mm-hmm. But I will say there are a lot of moments that come into being where just on an internal level, whether it's just me and the producers or the writers are looking at something and mm-hmm. going, well, that doesn't work narratively, but it's the truth.
Mm-hmm.
That is how we feel mm-hmm. about this subject. So like, how do we get that in there? Or are we in some dishonest way paying lip service to something, but not really owning it
yeah.
or wearing it in some way? And, you do your best with that. What I like about broadcast news is how quietly what you may in the future regard to be the wrong choice can kind of emerge. And it's not always obvious.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's a simpler question about what the right path would be.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's kind of hidden in the beginning and you have to really look at it and go, yeah, when we blow this up on a big screen, we might accidentally make something that's offensive in the wrong way
mm-hmm.
or is just untrue.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back in a moment talking more with David Bruckner. Then you'll have one quick thing about Adam Driver versus dinosaurs in the brand new trailer for the movie called 65. This has just come to my attention and it is filling my thoughts.
Hi, I'm Janet Varney, and just like you, I survived high school. And we're not alone. On my podcast, The JV Club, I invite some of my friends to share the highs and lows of their teen years, like moments with Aisha Tyler.
But when you're a kid, the stakes are just pretty low. Go to school, try not to get in trouble, get laid.
Jamila Jamil.
I watched television probably every waking hour during that time when I was shit-faced on medicine.
And Dave Holmes.
We talked and talked, and then everybody left. It was just us two, and I was like, I love you.
Learn how you too can be a functioning adult after the drama and heartbreak of high school. Every week on the JV Club with Janet Varney. Find it on Maximum Fun or wherever you get your podcasts. This is a judgment-free show.
Hal Lublin here with breaking news on a revolutionary form of entertainment, professional wrestling. For more, we go to our correspondent, Danielle Radford.
Professional wrestling is the craze that's sweeping the nation, featuring fisticuffs and colorful costumes.
But who can help us make sense of this world of body slams? Lindsay Kelk has the answer.
Sources tell us of an amazing podcast called Tights and Fights, filled with discussions of the absurdity of professional wrestling, plus all the sincerity and hilarity that you could shake a stick at.
Listen to the Tights and Fights podcast every week.
Find it on Maximum Fun or wherever you get your podcasts.
And your old-timey radio.
Welcome back to Feeling Seen. Director David Bruckner is my co-host today, and he brought a deliciously unexpected character with him. Holly Hunter's Jane from Broadcast News, the great 1987 film from James L. Brooks. And when I say great, I mean absolutely fantastic great. David has been directing films for a long time, but he recently made his first studio film with Hellraiser, which is where we will be picking up our conversation right now. You've spoken clearly about being aware that this is like a landmark queer text of horror cinema
yeah.
and that it is a text that is important to you individually. And so you have a reverence for the property as it exists as Hellraiser. You have an awareness for the resonance that this has with queer folks imbued by this like incredible transgressive erotic horror that Clive Barker created in his source material. And I wanted to hear from you about like the way that you maybe not necessarily wrestled, because that's a laden term, but the way that you really dove in to accessing that part of it, knowing that like our mores are different now. Transgression is different now. What played as a complete dangerous violation in 1988, things are a little bit different in the public sphere now. The billboards for American Horror Story's most recent season that are all up around at Los Angeles are Hellraiser imagery splayed across the mainstream landscape. And so I wanted to hear how you, because you clearly did take that seriously and you clearly did put thought into that. And I wanted to just hear some sort of like details from you about that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, totally. On some level, I think we took seriously the idea that it was a different time and that we were revisiting something that had a particular resonance when it came into being, and that we had to be true to the moment in thinking about what this meant now, but also paying homage to how it came to be. And so a lot of that, you know, we tried to, you know, give voice to the queer elements of the original in our casting and in the representation of the film in so many different ways. That felt absolutely essential. And then also in our design, we felt that we had to kind of rethink what some of those elements were. And so, you know, you may be talking about, a lot of people will notice the loss of black leather, which was a big swing, which was a big decision that we made. And
I think your choice to really lead into body modification was absolutely stunning.
Oh, that's great.
It was evocative, and I think it was a gorgeous choice.
That's great to hear. I know it's been divisive, I think, for some. And I think, look, some of it just comes from how I want to regard, you know, things that we love from the past.
Yeah.
Like, I appreciate iterative reinventions of things. To me, it helps me see them in different ways. Like, I'm somebody that loves that every few years we get a different Batman.
What I love about genre is that it is a space of remix and reinvention.
Yeah. And for us, we felt like, because black leather as a symbol, as an idea, as design element, had become so ubiquitous that it had infiltrated all corners of the culture, that it wasn't forbidden in the same way that it was in 87. And so, as it represented, in particular, the queer community in 87, and as it represented something that was transgressive or forbidden at the time, that we just couldn't get to the same feeling now. That what we would be doing is creating a sort of museum piece to something that had come before us, because that's how we remember it. And that's something that we do very much with the things that we love right now. Things are very nostalgia focused.
Totally.
And for us, it was a more daring move. It was kind of a gutsier reinterpretation to say, what if the Cenobites aren't necessarily tethered to a subculture? Like, what if that was one version that I'm sure will cycle back around at a later time, but that this was a vision of something that was a bit more eternal, that didn't exist within the parameters of something that we understand. That the Cenobites, if they were, you know, mired in human pursuits at extreme levels that were new to us or foreign to us or frightening to us, which I do think was the perception of it at the time, like that is what's baked into the original premise, that it wouldn't be on terms that were so familiar to us.
Right.
And that might make it off-putting or engaging in a new way. It might make it frightening, and that you could still get the basic tenets in there. You could still get, you know, the glamour that they carried, the vanity that existed sort of in the way they rendered themselves. And then it could still be BDSM, which was an important part of the original film. And so we really, really tried to make sure that the elements of, you know, bondage and discipline, and that the sadomasochistic sort of spirit of it, the dominance and submission and all the play inherent was still present in the way the Cenobites behaved and the way they interacted with their subjects. We just changed the iconography, but that was an exciting choice to us. And and honestly, my first conversations with Clive, it was we were kind of already off on that path. And but one of his first questions with me is like, how are you going to do BDSM now? Like, it's different. And so I showed him the designs, and he took to it, and he instantly got it and welcomed it as a departure. So we felt enthralled to pursue that. Yeah.
There is so much more the body can be made to feel. And you'll feel it all before we're through.
In original text Hellraiser, and in this text Hellraiser, these are stories of obsession. They're stories of obsessive pursuit. And then back in you know, the Night House there is very much, it is a, I think it's very much a story of an obsession as well. Like there are mental mm-hmm. health aspects of it too, but there's a fixation and a drive by Rebecca Hall's character towards something that she has to unpack. And then in Broadcast News, we have Jane like in an obsessively driven character to sort of uphold these norms and rights that she sees as true in her industry and in the world. And I wanted to hear from you about what is the draw. And you mentioned too, I think it's a great space to mention. You mentioned that like another movie, another set of characters you were kind of considering mulling over for this was Zodiac and like the protagonists mm-hmm. of that. And that is absolutely a story of obsessive pursuit. So I wanted to know what is so appealing to you about the well of obsession to keep going back to it. It's an extremely broad topic word, but like where does that primally just like keep pulling you back in?
I mean, it's always driven. It's certainly for me, I don't know why filmmaking stuck. I always thought I would get talked out of it in some way. So it's, and a movie is something that you just become fixated on towards the end to the nth degree. And by the end of it, you're just pulling everybody along. So, look, it's instantly relatable in that regard. And, something about possession is always, energized. It's always a bit perverse, and there's always an identity kind of crisis in the middle of it that you're working through. But I appreciate the valiant effort of connecting Broadcast News to Hellraiser. That might be the first time that's ever happened.
This is my job, to find the threads. And I think the obsession thing really comes. I don't even think it's a stretch to do it. I think it's right there for us.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, though, you know, it's interesting because I don't think that our Hellraiser movie is about obsession. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's been something that I think it's been criticized for a bit, and which I understand. I think that came more out of the idea that one of the ways that Hellraiser could exist in a contemporary way was that you might broaden the human pursuits that the box represents. Mm-hmm. So in the original film, it was, you know, hedonism and pleasures of the flesh. And one of the things that I thought was really exciting about this new piece was that David Goyer and Ben Collins and Lynn Petrowski had written the script, had found a way to sort of create these different iterations of the box that all demonstrated things that felt very Cenobite-like.
Lament. Lore. Laudaret, Liminal, Lazarus, Leviathan. What would you ask of us?
The lore configuration that's about wisdom is about pulling, you know, if the kind of hellish conclusion of that, the Cenobite version of that, should you choose lore, is to pull the veil back on the universe and receive too much data about how everything works.
Yeah.
Your head might explode. Who knows, you know? And then they had Laudaret, which was about love, which we can imagine if you sought to not be alone, what would it be like to coalesce with another being, to share their thoughts, to be codependent to the point of it, you know, being nightmarish to us. And then of course, liminal configuration, which is pleasure and the intersection of pain. And then Lazarus, which is resurrection, which is, I think, about permanence and time, shaped like an hourglass. It's about an eternity, which we can assume the Cenobites exist outside of our framework. And then Leviathan, which is about power and about the kind of desire to choose who faces what and to what extent to control the universe. And which, as we find out in the film, is about yourself being a Cenobite. And then of course, Lament, which is about the limitations. It's about accepting the, you know, the suffering of life and all the things that you will never see. And I always thought this first film was about lament.
You choose to live, to carry that weight, bitter and brief. You have chosen the lament configuration.
At the end of the film, when the priest speaks to Riley and she says, you know, bitter and brief. Jamie and I were talking about how to play it. And what we came to was just like, you know, have pity on her, like for all the things that she will never know. And so interestingly, like that it's such an energized topic, and it's something that I think I would love to explore in a Hellraiser film. I just think this first film was, it was what it got off on that was very, very clear to me mm-hmm. in being true to it was a story of someone who was negotiating the kind of consequence of her desires or running rampant, that she had to atone for something. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's a different story, but it's mm-hmm. one that's also not unfamiliar. Yeah.
Well, that I it's interesting to think, like, when films come to filmmakers in their lives, like you were saying, like, ultimately I'm glad that the Friday the 13th movie didn't work out because, like, I would have been ready for it at the time. And it's, I have to imagine that, like, if 2013 David gets Hellraiser, 2013 David must have, like, a different relationship and point of view on, like, grief and guilt because your life experience is just different. It's just crazy to me to think about, like, how, like, a different era in your life would have made this a totally different Hellraiser because of those very intimate and frightening sort of themes that you find yourself going back to. It's like, wow. It would 10 years ago Hellraiser have been, like, a darker movie? Or would it have been, like, a... No, I think there would have been more levity to it.
I think it would have been more smartass, for sure.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. It was on the heels of the Yachts. I mean, come on.
Yeah, yeah. I think the contemporary setting and me does manifest a bit of a different kind of responsibility for the material that comes out in filmmaking one way or another. But I love what you're saying. I don't know that... I wonder in talking with other filmmakers what you've come across here, but I sort of believe the basic thing that you can only tell your own story, and mm-hmm. it sort of will emerge whether you want it to or not.
Right.
And oftentimes it's only after the fact that you realize you set out to do this one thing, and then the movie's all said and done, and you're going, like, wow, I'm really just therapeutically processing this one thing in this movie that I've just put out in front of everybody. And
do they know?
Now I have, they know. Yeah. Yeah. It's all there.
Well, what do you think you're, you know, confronted with the priest at the end of the story? Is it an internal debate which configuration you would choose? Or do you know? Or are you walking away? You're like, oh, fuck no. I know I would go for that Leviathan man. Or are you like, no, I'm with Odessa. I'm walking out of that room.
I mean, at this year in my life, I would run screaming towards Lament. But maybe when I was younger, I would have ended up somewhere else. But one of the things I loved about the end of the script, and it's still those last few scenes are I just feel like the whole movie is building to that, mm-hmm. is that, you know, we tried to not make a judgment one way or the other. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Riley denies it in certain genre terms. She survives and makes what you would think is the obvious choice. But also, sure. Voight reaches transcendence. And so Voight's ascension is counterpoint to Riley's experience. And so everything that she will never understand, he's about to go on a journey. And he... I mean, he practically orgasms at the end. I mean, there is this sort of like realization that he has arrived at epiphany, staring in the light and knows now who he is. And so I sort of liked the question at the end of like, what would you choose? Mm-hmm. Where would you rather be?
Yeah. I mean, I don't even like water sports. So like, I'm not mm-hmm. looking for anything exciting here. Like I'm going Lament configuration. Like sure. I will sit on the sidelines while people go ski. So I'm not going to like test out what they might mean by one of their gifts with the configurations.
Yeah, yeah.
David, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about all of this today. I really appreciate it. And I'm so happy to have been given a reminder to go back and watch Broadcast News again. It had been too long.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. Fantastic questions. This was such a great conversation. Thanks, Jordan.
Thank you. I truly appreciate your time. Thank you again to David Bruckner. You can watch his Hellraiser film on Hulu. The Night House, which I referenced in this episode, is also on Hulu if you want to watch one of the great horror performances of the past like decade from Rebecca Hall. And if you want to check out Broadcast News, one of the great performances in a journalism movie ever given by Holly Hunter, it is available to rent on demand pretty much anywhere. It's a classic. Educate yourself if you haven't done it. Revisit it if you already have. And now my one quick thing before I go. This came out of nowhere, guys. Trailer pops up on Twitter. It's just called 65. And it starts, it's like one of my action Twitter go-tos, the film commenter and journalist Vice Victus was like, he was like, dinosaurs and lasers. Sometimes it's just that simple. And I was like, well, great. What's going to be in here? And I'm thinking like some like cool direct to streaming thing, like, oh, really? Dinosaurs, lasers. This doesn't seem like it could be. This doesn't seem like it could include an A-lister. And I hear the voice coming from the screen as I'm watching like a spaceship crash into a pastoral earth, into a verdant planet, unnamed planet so far. And then I realize that is Adam Driver. That is Adam Driver in this sci-fi movie that I'm told has dinosaurs and lasers getting out of this crash-landed craft. And the voice, like the title cards are like giving us little bits of information at a time. And then it says, it comes out with, we've got Adam Driver in our hands, and it says, 65 million years ago. And it's like, whoa, okay. So what you're telling me is that past Adam Driver is from in some intergalactic population of human beings, and he crash landed on Earth in the age of the dinosaurs, this Earth, 65 million years ago, which when you get that 65 million years ago, we only say as a people, we only say 65 million years ago, and we're talking about dinosaurs. If you ever say the words 65 million years ago, you are talking about something that involves dinosaurs. That's the only reason to reference that point of time. Honestly, I don't even know. I couldn't tell you for sure. Is it the Jurassic period? Is it the Cretaceous period? I don't know specifically, so I'm not going to use the word Jurassic, but it's dinosaurs. And so we get the 65 million years ago tip. And then what crashes into the frame but a dinosaur? And this movie reveals itself as, oh, he also finds a little girl in the forest. So then he becomes a very Mandalorian style sci-fi sudden dad to a small cute child. So he must protect child, presumably aim to take her with him off of Earth, what we are now know to be Earth, wherever he's from. I don't know where he's from. But to succeed in surviving, they will have to fight dinosaurs. This is Adam Driver. This is a dinosaur fighting a dinosaur. As Amanda Smith, Disaster Girls co-host, said to me in a chat, this is megafauna versus megafauna. Driver v. Dinos. And this movie looks like it's a deep fake. Like, that looks like the only way that this movie consists is somebody deep faked Adam Driver onto a person, and some person who loves to do VFX in their free time was like, oh my God, I would love to see Adam Driver and Space Gun versus dinosaurs. And then they just whipped up a fake trailer for a movie that can't possibly exist in their home. That's what this is. And it's from Bronze Studios. So that's a real place. So this movie's coming and it's real and it's called 65. And it is like, it says like in theaters. So this is a theatrical release. Adam Driver, thanks to you. Thank you for getting the script and being like, yes, I will. I'm Adam Driver. Yes, I will. That's amazing. That's an incredible statement to your talent and integrity. And that is our show. You can follow us on Twitter at FeelingScenePod or send us an email at feelingscene@maximumfun.org. If you want to follow me, I am Jor Crew on Twitter, JORCRU. Our theme music is produced by Andrew Epen. The show is produced by Marissa Flaxbart. Our senior producers are Kevin Ferguson and Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.